The light comes on, right? There we go. So, good afternoon. I'd like to convene the Joint Committee on Ways and Means for Public Safety. Today is February 7th, 2017, and we will open and continue with our informational meeting with Julie presenting from LFO. And feel, as we did yesterday, if you guys have questions throughout, feel free to raise your hand and we'll address them as we go.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Committee members, good afternoon. I wanted to start by introducing some folks I neglected to introduce yesterday, and that is our analysts that will work with the subcommittee from the Chief Financial Office across the street at DAS. These are the folks who put together the governor's budget that we'll be referring to and talking about. Dustin Ball is here sitting in the back. And yesterday, Michelle Lisper was sitting in the back, and I neglected to introduce her then. But those are the two CFO analysts. They also would be happy to answer specific questions that you may have as things come up about the governor's budget. So with that, we left off yesterday. We talked a lot about process and details, and today we're going to review a few numbers and statistics and introduce some of the issues that the committee will be faced with as time goes on. So just to start off, the biennium that we're in right now, the 15-17 biennium, this is the total all funds budget for the current biennium.
I have a question already, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
It's going to be a long day.
I'm sorry. Julie, are the meeting materials for today on yesterday's?
Yes, sorry. Thank you. Will also be true of the agencies that we hear from more than one day. All of their materials, their presentations, and everything will be posted on the first day of the period of time. Thanks. So this is yesterday, and it's slide number 18. So this was an increase from the prior biennium, from 13-15. And one of the things that always catches people's eyes until they're used to it is the fact that we budget for a biennium. So when you see an 8% increase, a 12% increase, you kind of have to divide by two, or else you say to yourself too often, well, nothing goes up that fast year over year. And this is an important thing on this slide. You can see that the general fund, the part of the budget that we are most concerned with, is really only about 25% of the overall funds. We get quite a lot of money from the federal government, and we get 41% of the budget from other funds, which, as we talked about, is a wide variety of fees and dedicated taxes, things like that. So these are the fund types that come in. And these are the ways that we, in the current biennium, have chosen to spend those dollars. This is by program area. You can see that human services, by far and away, is the biggest single chunk. But if you add up education funding, it adds up to a considerable amount as well. Public safety that we work on and judicial is 6.3% of the total all funds budget. I wanted to point out, you know, people are drawn to the large, eye-catchingly pink wedge of the pie called administration. And you look at that and you say to yourself, holy smokes, that is a lot of administration. That slice of the pie refers to the administration program area. So it's actually all of the budgets that are included in that kind of group. So it's budgets like the Department of Administrative Services, the Governor's Office, OLCC, PERS, the Department of Revenue, Treasury. It's a great number of agencies. And the largest dollar amount in that slice, $9.7 billion, is actually PERS payments to retirees. So that's one of those instances of non-limited funds that we talked about yesterday, since the number of retirees receiving a benefit varies year over year. So this pie chart shows just the general fund and lottery fund slice, this yellow slice that we saw back there. So this is how, amongst the program areas, the general fund and lottery funds have been divvied up. Again, public safety is not the largest share of that, but it's a sizable chunk, 16%. This is really where you see how much of the state's sort of discretionary funding goes to support education. So this just shows some budget history over the past about 18 years and how the budget has grown over time. The yellow bars on the bottom are general fund, and the green bars are other funds, that kind of 42% share of the current biennium's budget. You can see also that the amount of federal funding that we get has increased quite a bit over the past 10 years or so. And this again is just general lottery fund growth over time. So these are the expenditures by categories. We talked about budget categories yesterday, and this is really this really shows how much we send out in special payments. That includes all of the dollars we send to school districts, to counties for support for various programs, all those sorts of things. Personal services chunk is all of the costs that are included in paying for state employees, all of the state employees. So that would be healthcare, salary, benefits, PERS, things like that. So there are quite a lot of drivers of budget change. And you look at this list and you think, well, you know, pretty much everything drives budget change, and that's pretty true. Oregon's population has grown by 50% since 1985, so we just have more people here. And for particular programs that the state funds, the demographics matter a lot. The number of people who are senior citizens, the number of people who are young, all of those school-age populations, that all matters quite a bit. Other big categories here are inflation, healthcare costs. Mandated caseloads affect some departments more than others.
Rep. Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I thought it might be advantageous for me to go on the record to point out that I moved here in 84, so I'm not a part of the problem that Julie was pointing.
Well, let's see, the budget has increased drastically since you moved here. So, thank you. Go ahead, Julie.
Thank you. So mandated caseloads, we will see reference to mandated caseloads when we talk with the Department of Corrections and with the Oregon Youth Authority, because that affects those two agencies in our program area. Either legislatively referred initiatives or citizen initiatives can be a great cost driver. We'll see a little bit later on. I have a slide about the period of time when Measure 11 went into effect, that instituted mandatory minimum sentences, and that drove just a great trajectory of prison growth. So that can be, things like that can be quite a cost driver. We hear a lot about the public employees retirement system as a cost driver, and replacement of one-time revenues. I heard a very good question this morning as I listened to a different committee about, you know, what is it about one-time revenues? Why is that a big deal? And that is, that's because we often start a new program, we get an infusion of federal dollars intended to jumpstart something, and then when those dollars go away, we're left with continuing the program or being faced with the choice of having to stop doing it.
Oh, hold on just a moment.
Have you found it?
Yeah.
Rep. Huffman is playing IT.
You're going to taught me everything I know.
Okay. Go ahead.
Thanks. And, of course, policy choices that we make here in Oregon have a big effect or can have an effect on driving budget change. I think we've now met for 2 days, and so you're familiar with many, many, many budget challenges facing this legislature. There may be some issues with rebalancing the 15-17 budget. There will be an early session rebalance bill, and that won't touch on this subcommittee too much, except for the fact that the Department of Corrections is likely to need additional dollars in the current biennium because of a known shortfall that we left them with in 15-17. So that will be something that comes along in the current biennium.
Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Thank you. Julie, is there a plan? I got a little confused a while back when the E-Board met, and we didn't advance the $3.8 million request for the women's build-out of OSP. Will we, will the E-Board be dealing with that? Because Senator Devlin gave us till March 15th. How are those questions going to be answered since we're kind of in the middle of budgeting?
Well, thank you. Currently, the numbers that were in question are looking very good. And so I've heard nothing from my good colleague, Senator Devlin, that if things continue the way they are, we will not be going forward that $3.8 million request. As you probably have guessed, or may or may not know, Marion County has signed their PREA. They're probably now, as we speak, up to 20 ladies. The Lane County was in their process, so that they were going to add and be at 6. Klamath is also in the mix, although Multnomah County is not ready yet, and they're only doing, I call it bid swaps. And I understand that your area also would be beds. And that's only if we're at the stage to where we actually need that. So it looks like at this stage, and I'm sure that the good representative Palooza can add on, because we had a meeting, a week or so ago? To get the new numbers and to see where we are. And I'm very appreciative of the counties that have rolled up their sleeves and worked together to try to make certain that we lower the census count at Coffee Creek. Because in addition to what's going on at the county level, the numbers itself were beginning to decline. So, you know, you've got two hydraulics that's running.
Thanks for the update.
Yeah.
And a quick side, is everybody here familiar with PREA, what that was all about? So for the record, if someone's watching, well, you're having a slow day if you are. But PREA, so we are exploring the idea of allowing some of the counties to receive back certain specific inmates during their last year. And there's a lot of details behind it. Before a county can even be considered, they have to go through what's called a PREA certification, Prison Rape Elimination Act, and then they can be considered. There's a few counties that have already completed that. There are some counties in process and some considering. So those are all factors that she's referring to.
And that particular certification is required by the federal government.
Yes.
Thank you. And just as little small coda on the end of that. That would be something that we would want to consider in an early session bill if, as the senator said, it was an issue. The emergency board won't meet again since you all are in session now. So that would be something that we might deal with if we had to. So not to read this whole list, but you know, one of the things that happened in the election last time was that several ballot initiatives were successful. All of the ones that did not come with funding were successful. And so that's not exactly what we might consider a current service level issue, but they did pass, and funding them will be a challenge for the upcoming biennium. So there have been a lot of questions about what is current service level? Like, what do we talk about? So we're going to just digress for a minute and talk about what current service level actually is. How do we get to a starting place that's fair for every to think about everybody's budget? So generally, the process is we start with the budget that we have in the current biennium, and we make some adjustments. We take out things that we know are not going to recur, and we add some things that we know will occur in the upcoming biennium. We make adjustments to anticipate known personal services costs for the upcoming year, and that would be changes in PERS, changes in people's salary, changes in benefit levels, and there's a statewide system, actually, that does that calculation. So no agency is left to go off on its own and say, you know, I think my people are awesome, they should get a lot more money this year. That's all calculated based on the labor agreements in place right now. We make adjustments for debt service. Quite often, Capital Construction approves new projects in a budget, and we decide that we will issue the debt for those projects right toward the end of the biennium. So we will have, for example, a big bond sale probably in May. Well, the debt service for that will be due the following biennium, but not in the current one. So there's always an adjustment to add debt service for bonds that have been sold prior. It also happens, because we budget for 2 years, that some things start in the middle of a biennium. You come up with a great new program, you identify a way to pay for it, and it takes a while to ramp things up. So we'll include in the first biennium enough funding for that program for its first year. But then the following year, we have to include enough for both years. So we factor that in. And likewise, we phase out programs that we know are going to end. Maybe they were a pilot program, maybe it's just done. And so that gets removed, so the funding doesn't stick around for that. Inflation is applied to all of the items that are in the services and supplies line. And the inflation amount that agencies are allowed to apply is prescribed in the executive department's budget instructions. So people can't really come and say, well, I think inflation is going to be higher or lower, what have you. Inflation is a place, just as a budgeting aside, inflation is something you can kind of make a decision about. Inflation is something that you don't have to include in a budget for an agency. It's prudent to do it because it's reasonable to expect that costs will increase, but also reasonable people disagree about how much that might be. So that is something about inflation. Generally, we set a different rate for medical inflation because our experience has been that it runs higher than inflation on pencils. And there are a few exceptions for particular circumstances. An agency can come in and say, I know I'm going to do this thing, and it's going to be 10% more next time. And so they can make that argument, and the chief financial office decides whether or not to allow that increase.
Mr. Chair?
Go ahead.
Thank you. Julie, is there any back and forth between the executive branch and the legislative in maybe even arguing about the general inflation rate and the medical inflation rate, or do you guys come to a consensus agreement on those numbers, or?
I think that we do. I'll have to find out more about that because I'm not involved in those conversations, but there's quite a bit about the budget instructions that go out to executive agencies that we do at least talk about with the chief financial office. So I'll find out exactly how that happens.
I appreciate it. I was just kind of curious if we just accept their number or if we consider it, but maybe come up with our own number that we think might reflect the market a little better or whatever.
Thank you. I will look into that one. We also have some agencies that need to budget for mandated caseloads. For example, the Department of Corrections is required to budget based on a certain prison population forecast. Those are issued twice a year by the Office of Economic Analysis at DAS, and they have to use that to for their budget planning. So that's something that gets factored in if you're an agency that is subject to mandated caseloads. And then we also do a thing called fund shifting, and that's where if, say, you were receiving a grant for an important service and the grant ends, you can ask to have that backfilled with general fund. It can also go the other way. You can receive a grant that can supplant some of the general fund dollars you've been spending on that program.
Like that.
As you can imagine, that doesn't happen that often. It's been widely remarked upon that the growth in the current service level for this biennium is quite a bit higher than it was for the current biennium. The current service level is 15.6% higher than the legislatively approved budget in the current biennium. And so this chart shows the components of that growth. So just to kind of go around from the top, the state position adjustments are just that. It's positions that maybe were added in the middle of a biennium. Those get annualized. Positions routinely get reclassed. Things like that. Debt service, I just talked about how debt service gets factored in for debt that gets sold in a prior biennium. Net phase-ins is just kind of a catch-all for things that were planned to start in the middle of a biennium. And then that big purple chunk says inflation. And that, of course, is not just the 3.7% inflation on services and supplies for the state budget. You remember we saw in a slide prior how much of the budget goes out in special payments, and that's inflation that also applies to those payments to school districts, to counties, to other jurisdictions, and that is why that is such a big chunk. There's a 12% of it is caseload growth, and 19% of it is to replace one-time funds in the current biennium. I heard someone ask in a different subcommittee earlier today whether or not that's normal. And we're going to look into that, and I'll pass along the answer to all of you. That seems to be a higher than usual amount of replacing one-time funds, and I think that it's well, I think I should get you an answer in writing before I say something that isn't right. And then you see that there's the dark blue wedge, which is the ballot measures that passed in the last election that came without funding. And as I said, that's not strictly speaking a current service level problem because we don't have them right now, but we will have them in the upcoming biennium.
Mr. Chair.
Mm-hmm.
Because it does deal with one of our budgets. One of the things that I've been struggling with and I need some explanation on is the veterans ballot measure. Was it 96? 96, right? The veterans ballot measure?
You mean the number?
Right. Yeah, the ballot measure number. So the ballot measure called for the lottery pot of money didn't grow because of the ballot measure. The ballot measure called for dedicating a portion of already dedicated monies.
The general fund, essentially, money.
No, this was
no,
this
lottery
was,
fund.
No, yeah, lottery
but,
fund.
But that would go to the, if we were taking up the veterans, it would end up in the general fund.
Right.
Yeah.
I guess I'm missing why I've heard the co-chairs talk about that having an impact on the general fund budget, because we're not expanding that pot of money. So where am I missing the math?
If I may, if my understanding is, so the pot of money would have gone into the general fund. Now we're saying, no, you can't have it in the general fund. It's going to the veterans. So then that leaves the hole that would have been in the general fund, where that money would have been in the general fund.
Okay, I thought it was coming out of dollars that were dedicated to other programs. Those other programs would take a little hit, but the pot wouldn't expand.
Any other?
Mr. Chair, if I may. Representative Huffman, I appreciate your confusion on this, but the biggest issue is that the vast majority of the lottery funds go towards schools as opposed to any other programs. Right. And so essentially the money for the veterans, which don't get me wrong, I voted for.
Because
money is fundable, you have to backfill the money from the lottery fund that would have gone towards schools out of general fund.
Better explanation, thank you.
No problem. Does that help?
Yes,
cool.
Thank you.
Happy to help.
You know, just to pile on that conversation, and I think it's very noteworthy to note that what we do in this building, even though it's lottery funds or general funds and even federal funds, that where you take the balloon and squeeze it at one end in order to do what you want, it's going to pop out someplace else at the other end. So in this case, it's where you look at the pie for lottery funds and that distribution. Inside of that, was the educational component. And so, you know, it's always talking about the unintended consequences for everything you do. Something else in this building is going to have maybe that unintended consequence.
Good point. Okay, let's continue.
Thanks.
Measure five is a good thing.
The co-chair's framework balances to a different number than the governor's budget does. And this slide is intended to show the difference between the governor's budget and the co-chair's framework. In a nutshell, the governor's budget was able to include about $750 million more in expenditures because it assumed that there were some additional revenues that the co-chairs didn't assume. The co-chair's framework is based on current law, so a few examples of some of the revenues included in the governor's budget would be an increase in tobacco tax, an increase in the hospital assessment or tax, and the co-chairs didn't want to make any assumptions about what the body would choose to do with regard to additional revenues. So that's just a little illustration of that.
Julie, are there, in that difference, are there funds that we expect to receive from the feds that were not counted? Things, you know, federal grants and so forth that we would normally receive and have historically received but have not yet been renewed but we do expect to get?
Mr. Co-Chair, I would have to get back to you about that. I don't think so.
Okay.
So we're going to do just a little overview of a few things in kind of our purview for the next several weeks. This would have been a good slide to have yesterday when everyone was saying, what are the agencies in our in our area? But these are the agencies that we will hear from, several executive branch public safety agencies, and several judicial branch public safety agencies. And you can see that these, just even looking at the array of agencies, lets you know, as Senator Winter said yesterday, that public safety is really a system. It really all kind of fits together in an important way. We saw this on an earlier slide, but public safety takes up 16% or so of the general fund, combined general fund and lottery funds for the upcoming biennium. This is, we talked a lot about the current biennium, this is for next time. Education is still the big dog in this particular slide. Public safety spending as a percent of all general fund lottery fund spending has kind of gone up a little bit and has leveled off between 16-17% over the past 10 years or so. Of all the resources that we spend on public safety, 74% of that comes from the general fund. So we are an important player in the general fund.
Mr. Chair?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, Ms. Nabucco, I don't know when the right time is to ask this question, and it may not be until we get DOC in here testifying, but you might just put it on your radar. I'm really interested to understand about how the cost of medications is playing into prescription drugs is play, and healthcare costs in general is playing into DOC's budget. So if you could just, you don't have to talk about it now, but it just occurred to me to bring that up so that you could put it on DOC's radar. I'd be grateful.
And Mr. Chair, in relationship to that, Sovaldi, for example, and the differences in the health care and pharmaceutical budget for DOC over the last couple of years since we approved
that's one of the things that, that occurred to me, Representative Huffman.
Which
hepatitis C stuff.
You may want to ask Mr. Chair Colette to actually talk about aging population. And the because the population inside of DOC is aging, the population coming in, if it's 25, is really at real time 35. So you're adding 10 years coming in. In addition, ask her what percentage of her individuals are in mental health population. I think that she can give a good picture on. You might want to also understand what savings, if any, that we receive because they're doing, they're part of a compact to do bulk purchasing of with, because they combine with other states in order to do the bulk purchasing. And had they not had that, because I know we did a study to see if we did the one that we have in the state vis-a-vis what they're doing and what's the outcome. And the outcome then was that she saves more money by doing the interstate with the bulk than she does in doing the one that we had that was started by us. So you might want to ask her what those numbers are.
And we've reviewed the elder people in prison and found out that most of them are murderers or child molesters. Therefore, I mean, because we talked about why not release them when they are old.
Yeah.
And that's why.
So combined, but the medical costs, the issues on the on medical costs. And so, you know, if we're going to look at this, we've got to look at the, you know, what's inside the institution and the aging population that is consuming, like the population in our and among the general, what is consuming the cost. And I irrespective of the HIV issue, which is also another issue.
Thank you. I'll pass this along to the Department of Corrections so that they are ready. They also, I know, will want to talk about issues that they have that are also national about recruiting medical professionals to work in the prisons. So this is a little bit hard to see from a long way away, but I put it up here to show that the Department of Corrections will certainly be our biggest budget to work on this session. The Department of Corrections accounts for 40% of all the public safety agency spending and 52% of all the general fund spending that we will consider. The Department of Justice and the Judicial Department put together account for 23% of all that, and the State Police, Youth Authority, and Military Department each account for about 9% of the overall agency spending. So that just gives you sort of an order of magnitude of the size of the budgets for these agencies. There's also five little agencies that we'll look at over the next few weeks, and they account for 3% of all the public safety spending. And just under 3% of all the general fund spending. One of the things to note is that will come up when we hear from DPSST tomorrow is that you can see that they have quite a long gray bar on this chart, and that represents other funds. The Department of Public Safety Standards and Training is largely funded from a funding source called the criminal fines account. And the criminal fines account is considered to be kind of interchangeable with general fund. What isn't spent on the statutory requirements from the criminal fines account kind of reverts to the general fund. So when we think about them, that's a little bit more of a flexible other funds agency than any of the others you might come across. Public safety is a people business. Most of the expenditures for public safety, the largest share of those go toward personnel. And because we also provide quite a bit of housing, services and supplies is a big chunk as well. The special payments category represents the funding, again, that gets demonstrated to other jurisdictions. In addition to the things I have noted on the slide, community corrections and juvenile crime prevention grants, the Public Safety Defense Services has $282 million of, Public Defense Services Commission has $282 million of pass-through payments for public defenders throughout the state.
Mr. Chair. I'd just like to go back so that you can add to the medical list. Ask, because there, the DOC has 14 cities, that's what I call them. And because there is the issue, not all of the cities are in metropolitan Portland area, nor are they in Salem in the Valley. So when you look at medical costs, some of the individuals have to transport in other, you know, like, for example, they don't have the hospital or some of the other services available, so they're having to transport other places in the state. If you're in the Ontario area, you're probably going to Idaho. If you're in the area in, for example, Hermiston and what have you, you may be going over into Washington in order to get care and services. So you may want to ask her of how much are we having to do with outstate and what kind of agreements that we have medically with those particular institutions and services outstate.
Thanks. Public safety is a system, a little schematic, cogs in a wheel. And these are the public safety system partners that state agencies work with. And there's just a whole variety of things. We'll hear more about local jails, again, when we talk about the women's prison situation. But all of these are very important partners for state agencies to run well. So there are a lot of budget drivers for public safety, and some of them are not what you think they might be. We'll see a couple of slides from now that statutory changes or ballot measures have made some of the biggest changes to public safety budgets in the last 20 years.
Yeah, thank you.
Demographic changes have an effect. The prison population forecast relies heavily on demographics as a way to forecast prison intakes, which is an important thing to know about when you are looking at the growth of the prison population over time. The availability of and funding for mental health and substance abuse treatment is a big deal. Many property crimes are driven by people with active substance abuse problems, and sometimes services are not available for those folks should they seek them out. One of the things that we've heard a lot about over the past 10 years is the availability of local funding for law enforcement, particularly in counties that had relied a lot on timber severance payments. Of course, the growth in the prison population is a cost driver, and likewise, the growth in the population of people on parole, probation, and post-prison supervision. And there's more. State labor costs drive the 53% of the budget that is made up of personnel costs. There are other cost pressures, some of which we talked about with the costs of prison health care. Both of our agencies that incarcerate people, the Department of Corrections and the Youth Authority, operate medical clinics within their institutions. And so drug costs and the cost of providing health care in that kind of a situation drives costs quite a bit. Of course, there's crime, prevalence of illegal business operations in the state. And the demand for laboratory services has been discussed quite a bit in the last several sessions, especially with regard to testing a giant backlog of sexual assault forensic evidence kits that are held by jurisdictions all over the state. And then, of course, there's the caseload and staffing levels for many of the players in the criminal justice system, the courts, the district attorneys, the public defenders, again, local law enforcement. So prison operations are the largest single expense in the public safety system for the state. The prison population since 1985 has grown by 302%. I didn't initially believe this. But, you know, 30 years ago is 30 years ago. We'll see in a few slides that Oregon's violent crime rate and property crime rates both peaked in about the early to mid 80s. And so this is a result of that peak, because when you're on the upside of that trajectory, you can't see what's going to happen. So we're kind of living with
Mr. Chair.
The after effect of that.
So, Ms. Nabrika, I'm not trying to put you on the spot on this one, but are you, I just want to make sure I understand what you're saying. Are you saying that, in essence, it's kind of like the PERS problem? You know, we know that as Tier 1 beneficiaries age and die, our PERS problem will eventually go away. No offense meant to Tier 1 beneficiaries like my husband, who I don't want to see die anytime soon. But you're saying that you think that this rise is largely attributable to the peak in the early to mid-80s, and that these people age out or finish their terms or die, that we're going to see a downtrend? Because we passed 1157 well after the mid-80s. So I'm a little confused.
Right.
I'm not trying to be difficult. I'm trying to clarify.
I understand. I think that the short answer is no. Right, prison populations depend a great deal more on how we respond to crime than it actually occurring. And so what we have put in place that has made that happen, unless we actively change that, sentencing laws, charging practices, all those things that get people into a prison, that is the thing that will make that trajectory go down.
So, Foth, if I may, Mr. Chair, thank you. So, in other words, essentially, you're saying that despite the fact that our crime rate has gone down, our prison population has tripled per 1,000 residents.
Well, it went down.
It's a matter of opinions.
Yeah.
So, yeah, so we'll get to that as well. There's, we've quickly gotten into the complicated part.
It's complicated.
This is a similar chart. It just shows the populations of offenders on parole, probation, and post-prison supervision. That's been more steady, and I apologize for the spike. I contacted the Department of Corrections about that data, and that was right when they implemented a new system, and they think that something happened there that wasn't related to the number of people on supervision. So the public safety system has gotten more expensive since 1985. And 1995 is a great, that little column for 95-97 shows the effects of decisions that we can make about how the public safety system operates. A lot of things happened right around 1995. The Oregon Youth Authority was created. There Measure 11 was passed, and that is the mandatory minimum sentence law. And so that caused our assumptions about the prison populations or the incarcerated populations to grow quite a bit. So the big blue chunk on that bar shows quite a lot of bond funding that was issued in that biennium for construction of prisons, for construction of OAA facilities. And there was also some bond funding available for Oregon Military Department facilities. And since their peaks in 1985 and 1981, crime rates generally have fallen. And there are a lot of explanations for why this is the case, which I'm absolutely not the best person to talk to about that. So the property crime rate in Oregon peaked in 1981, and the violent crime rate in Oregon peaked in 1985. So a lot of things affect the crime rate. And I just pulled this list off of the U.S. Department of Justice website because I thought it was illustrative of the kinds of disciplines that look at crime in the United States. Demographics, sociology, all kinds of things are thought to have an effect on the crime rate, including the climate. I found that interesting. But apparently warm weather isn't good for the crime rate. One of the factors that, again, the Office of Economic Analysis that puts together the Youth Authority and the Department of Corrections prison population forecasts looks at is the population of young men between the ages of 15 and 39, because those are thought to be a young person's most criminally active years. So there are quite a lot of things that we will hear about from all of the agencies that come and talk to us this session. And this is not, sadly, this is not an exhaustive list. The state police will come and talk to us about the numbers of state workers. I think many of us know that there is not 24/7 state patrol coverage in the state.
What was the year that Governor T was no longer governor? We haven't had the same number of troopers on the road since then.
I don't remember.
1986.
Pull him out of that. When they pull them out of the gas tax.
Right.
That was 1981.
So right after that.
The record should probably reflect that was before Representative Huffman moved to Oregon.
Nicely done, Ms. DeMurco. Very nicely done.
We may also hear quite a bit about deferred maintenance. Deferred maintenance is a statewide issue. It's not particular to these agencies, but these agencies do have a number of deferred maintenance issues. You've probably read about lead abatement requirements for the military department armories. And the military department does have a federal commitment to pay for that abatement, but we have still a lot of questions about exactly what that will look like. Another thing that will come up is the nonprofits that provide residential treatment services to youth in OIA's custody. That's what behavioral rehabilitation services are. That service has been underfunded for quite a long time, and some of the providers are starting to get out of the business. So that's a big concern for both our human services agencies and the Youth Authority. You will no doubt hear quite a lot about Coffee Creek, which is the one prison that we have for women in Oregon. It's currently full, although, as Senator Winters noted, the numbers are looking much better than they had been for a while. DPSST tomorrow will tell you about hiring and training public safety officers. The Criminal Justice Commission, who will be here next week, will talk about justice reinvestment. And then there's, again, the issue about capacity in the Oregon State Police forensics labs. For some of the justice agencies, they will have concerns about adequate funding for the defense of criminal convictions. I think juvenile dependency representation has been an issue for several biennia, and that goes on. The item at the bottom of this list that says assessing and classifying sex offenders is kind of the big issue for the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision. It's a new statutory requirement that they have, and they have been struggling with completing that task for a little while now. You'll hear from the judicial branch about courthouse replacement and renovations and funding for e-court and court technology support. There's sort of a perennial issue of caseloads and the costs of public defense services. There might be a current biennium budget shortfall there, although Steve Bender would be the person to ask about that rather than me. And last slide. These are the analyst assignments and phone numbers for the folks you'll be working with in LFO this session. So you can print this out. It's in big letters. And call people if you have particular questions about those agencies.
Great. Do we have questions? Or any comments for the good of the order? All right. Well, then on that note, we'll close the informational meeting, and we will adjourn. Thank you.
Good job.
See you tomorrow.
Well done, Representative. Well done, Representative.